This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It is Meera Sivasuthi. A report by the Commons Science and Technology Committee in the UK found that women are failing to reach the most senior levels of the scientific profession because of ingrained biases and the perception that science is a masculine subject. There is no single explanation for this, but we have Dame Wendy Hall, Professor of Computer Science and Dean of the Faculty of Physical Science and Engineering, University of Southampton, UK, to share her thoughts with us. Welcome to the show, Dame. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. It's lovely to see the sunshine.
Coming from that side of the world at the moment. You know, Common Science and Technology Committee, that report just came out.
It's very recent.
Very recent. What were your thoughts on that?
I suppose, firstly, really good to see the spotlight shining in the right place, which is the whole cultural issue of women in science. And secondly, just... nothing's changed. You know, it's just doesn't get any better. And there was a fuss on Twitter yesterday when Elsevier, the publisher, had put up a big photo, a set of photos on their website of famous scientists they have publishing with them, and they were all men. And this was just yesterday on Twitter. And there was a huge, you know, fuss about it. And Elsevier said, oh, well, we can't help it if all the Nobel Prizes go to men. They then backpedaled and said, oh, of course, our policy is diversity and we encourage women. But, you know, it's still that image that, you know, men are good at science and women just don't appear.
What was it like when you started off?
Oh, far actually worse, I suppose.
Yeah. You've somehow managed.
People ask me how I've done it, and I say one step at a time, because when I set out, I was a mathematician originally, and I knew I wanted to teach. I didn't set out to become a famous scientist. And then I moved into computer science, and there's a huge, exciting world there, and I'd just become very passionate about it, and I, just pushed and pushed in terms of I was excited about the world of multimedia and the web and being of the moment, I was able to have my voice heard. But, you know, my very first job interview when I was a mathematician, I went for an interview for a temporary job at a university in the UK, not Southampton, and I didn't get it. And I was told I didn't get it because I was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first job interview.
And, you know, we have you have discrimination laws, so do we.
Oh,
right?
Well, I'm quite old these days. And so this was back in the 70s, before the discrimination laws, really, just as they were coming out. I've benefited from those during my career, but this was back before there were laws for equal opportunities.
What got you persevering?
I think just... I suppose my love for the subject, some really fantastic support along the way. Today we call it mentoring. In those days, it was just people who gave you advice.
Mm-hmm.
Often it was men because there weren't many women around. There weren't many women role models when I started out. And so people who just believed in what you were doing and supported you. And I guess a strong personality, but that's evolved. My confidence has grown.
There is always this perception that you have to be like a man in order to survive in this masculine world. Did that change your character, or do you think it was inherent?
I do think you have to be prepared to act as men do in networking.
Mm-hmm.
You have to... be prepared to go to the conferences, go to the dinners, belong to the societies. I've been president of several societies. That sort of profile really helps, and that is time. And a lot of women just can't do that.
Yes.
Or won't do that because they've got families.
Yes.
And my peer group... so women who graduated in the 70s and are now at the professor level like I am, or the senior professor, you know, the sort of level I'm at, many of us do not have children. I don't have children. And I have a lovely husband and very, very supportive husband. But And many of my peer group don't have children. And I took a decision in my 30s that actually I was enjoying my career, so I didn't want to stop and have a family.
So it was a choice that you made.
I'm not saying women should, of course. Yeah. Nowadays it's a bit easier. But there are decisions when you've got young children and people want, you know, there are conferences around the world. I think it's hard for people in business as well, because the pressure is you're told you have to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. Whereas in academia, you have to make a conscious effort to go to where it's happening and be at the conferences and present those papers. You have to have a profile in order to get the research funding and therefore win the prizes that get you in the, you know, top whatever lists. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a profile. People have to know who you are.
Yep. But just to go back a little, I mean, a lot has changed since the 1970s. Mm. Girls in the UK perform as well.
Or better.
Or even better. Mm. Do boys in, and we're just talking about science, technology, we're talking about engineering, as well as mathematics. Then why do the girls fall by the wayside?
Well, I think it's firstly, it's the family thing, right? There are too many pulls on the time, and secondly, it's that I think women just don't want to play the games that men play, the power games. Mm-hmm. It's not what motivates us a lot of the time, and so you see, and this is what this Science and Technology Committee report says, that where women get the PhDs and they do the research and they publish the papers, and then they don't want to go for those top jobs because they just don't want to have to play those games.
But what do you think women bring to the table as far as, you know, these areas are concerned?
Well, so much.
They need us for a balanced world.
They need the balance, the emotional support, the team building. I mean, there are of course men that can build teams, but it's that sort of alling. Somehow, women aren't so desperately competitive. Don't have to be the top dog. I don't feel I've got to be the top dog. Mm-hmm.
Is that the right spirit to have, though?
You can be ambitious without feeling you've got to walk over everybody else to get there. Now, I'm not saying this is very stereotypical, but, you know, there are, you know, the idea that men are very single focused and women think, you know, more
broader context.
We parallel process more. We think, and I think it's women will often have empathy with others more than men. Mm-hmm. So encourage other people, bring other people in, spot when someone's having a bad time and try and help them. Whereas sometimes the men will be very single focused about, we've got to get here, so we've got to do this, and, you know, you just have to pull through. And it's that sort of just difference in attitude, really, that a lot of women don't want to be like that.
Do you think you'll ever win the Nobel laureate?
Oh, there isn't one in computer science.
There isn't one in computer science.
No, there isn't one in mathematics, actually. It's a very interesting story. It's in his will. There cannot be a Nobel Prize in mathematics.
Is there a reason for that?
I forget what it is, but there is a reason for that. Something to do with his wife, I think, having an affair. We'd have to check that out. But it's definitely in his will that there's no Nobel Prize in maths, and because computing came out of maths, it sort of gets pulled. So even people like Tim Berners-Lee, there is no Nobel Prize that Tim Berners-Lee can win.
Okay.
But I will say, let me just say, there is now a prize for engineering, and the Royal Academy of Engineering set up the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, mm-hmm. which is trying to be the Nobel Prize for Engineering. And Tim and Vince Cerf and three other men won the first one of those for the work on the internet. And the ACM, the Association of Computing Machinery that I was president of, has the Turing Award, named after Alan Turing, which is considered the Nobel Prize for Computer Science.
Fantastic. So there is some hope.
I don't aspire to win.
We'll find a way around the system and, you know, find something for them. But still, very few women winning Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
Do you think it's a problem that sits within a woman, i.e. where she doubts herself and that in itself
I do think
is an obstacle?
We always, you know, there are again these stereotypes where a woman looks at a job advert and thinks about what she can't do, whereas a man looks at a job advert and says, I can do all of that, even if they can only do one aspect of it. Constantly doubting, constantly taking the blame for things, constantly thinking it's my fault that didn't happen. Even where I am, I still get those feelings. I haven't got a man's brain, so I don't know exactly how they are, but I think it's that single focus that they have, and they think differently about these things.
In many countries, and this is including Malaysia, the female population in universities now outnumber the male population. And what's your interpretation of that? And despite all of this, the women are still falling by the wayside?
Well, I think that, as you said, it's in the last 20 or 30 years, things have changed a lot. And women in most countries, there are some awful exceptions, but in most countries, women are encouraged into education, both by the state and by their parents. Are given the start in life that didn't have before. You know, when I went to the university in the 70s, I was one of the first in my family to go. So, because it was, you know, I'm one of the baby boomers post Second World War, and so nowadays I think women are and girls are encouraged, and they're bright, and they concentrate, and their schoolwork, and they get the high grades, and they get to university. So eventually, and I think this is what the committee report says, you know, we will get there because now that there is the majority of universities, I mean, look at what's happened in medicine. I don't know what it's like in Malaysia, but in the UK, something like 70 or 75% of university medical courses are women. 75% of those undergraduates are women. That will eventually feed its way through to the very senior posts. It's not yet, but eventually it will, because there's such a majority. But what the report says is it's too slow.
Right.
It's far too slow.
Of course.
I think that we have made huge progress in terms of getting girls into education. And we are, I mean, here I see in Malaysia, you have many more women doing science and engineering than we do in the UK. I mean, I think over 50% of your engineering courses are women?
Yes.
Well, we don't have anything like that. If we get 15%, we're doing well.
But then again, we have the problem of a leaky pipeline.
Yeah.
A lot of them, you know, quitting after a while when they start families and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're discussing women in science, technology, engineering and mathematics. When we come back, we'll find out more about Dame Wendy Hall's participation in the industry on The Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasodhi. If you have just joined us, Dame Wendy Hall in the studio with me, Professor of Computer Science and Dean of the Faculty of Physical Science and Engineering, University of Southampton, UK. We are discussing a report which came out in the UK by the Commons Science and Technology Committee. And the report found only about 17% of science, technology, engineering and math professors were female. Just one of the findings. Dame Wendy, you know, when you were, is it knighted? Is that the right word?
It's better than damed, I suppose.
The damehood. damehood.
It's the equivalent of, I like to say that knighthoods are the equivalent of being a dame.
But, okay. Close enough. But quite a number of scientists in the UK, women scientists, seem to have been conferred their damehood.
As dames.
Yes.
Well,
is that just to console you for not winning Nobel prizes?
No, I don't think so. If you look, the UK only created Dame. I'm not sure it's damehood or dameship. 100 years ago, there've been knights since the medieval times. Mm. So, and if you look at the lists, maybe, you know, there are a small number of women made dames every year. Maybe one scientist a year. So it's tiny compared to the number of knights. Still. But there has been a concerted effort over the last few years to recognise scientists generally with these honours, and women in particular. But it's still incredibly exceptional to get it. So
you've done very well.
Well, I don't want to be bragging about it, but it is still quite a
it carries
significant
weight.
Honor. Yeah.
Significant honor indeed. Yeah. And has that deanship made a difference in the voice that you've had in championing women in science, technology,
yes.
math and engineering? How so? How?
Well, programs like this, I do a lot of this in the UK. Talk about my life as a scientist. I get more media opportunities to do that. Mm-hmm. I just think that the more we are able to do that and say, hey, look, we are normal people, but we have and the career we do is just so exciting, which it is. I mean, we do have more women going into science and engineering in the UK now, which is really good. And you, I mean, as I said previously, you have so many girls here. I think being able to talk to them about careers in this area is really important.
I have a really interesting question for you. I mean, do you feel religion and science sit together? And does that drive
that's
you know,
hard to answer on
women to a certain extent in
you,
the
well
area?
I think I that's hard for me to answer because I think the UK is such a secular society now. I think religion is more important to Malaysian society than it is to the UK. There's still a lot of people in the UK that have very firm, strong beliefs, mm-hmm. but it doesn't drive our country like I think it does here. Mm-hmm. But I could be talking from ignorance. And also, I come from a Christian background. I don't know what pressures are for Muslim women, much, much harder maybe for us, for Christian.
But did religion play a role for you?
No.
Not at all.
My parents come from a very strong church background, but I think it's a very deep philosophical question as to whether you can be a scientist and believe in God.
Yeah.
Many, many famous scientists do believe in God and believe and say that their science has proven to them.
Because if you think about it, it involves a search for understanding. And
yeah.
The two
yeah.
have that yeah. in common, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but it's not what's driven me. One way or the other.
And did you ever envision the internet evolving into the current state that it is? And how did that work for you in this field? I mean, and it's changing at such a rapid pace yeah. every day. And you're from an entirely different generation. How did you take to all of that?
Well, my first boss in computer science was Professor David Barron, and he encouraged us all to use email in the 80s. And I found at first, I thought, hey, we should be talking to each other. You know, I don't want to email the person in the next office to me. But I think that I've always, from what really excited me about computers, because I'm famous for saying that I hated computers at university. I really didn't want to have anything to do with them. But what excited me was when the personal computers came along and we could put pictures and videos and text on them. And I thought, this is going to change the way people access information, get educated. And I got very excited about that. And of course, the internet was a way to send files basically between computers, so suddenly you could say, here's a picture of me and I can send you this. and actually I was working on hypermedia systems, the idea of linking between different documents in the 80s, and I met Tim at a hypertext Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web, at a conference in 1990 where we were talking about our hypertext systems. And he had this idea that became the World Wide Web, which of course became the way that we interact with the internet. The idea that you can put up a web page with standard, open and standard protocols, and you can link from one document to another over the internet was so powerful. And lots of people have been working on it before, but he pulled it together in a way that worked. And in particular, he gave it away. Mm-hmm. It was free.
Yep.
So, and that was really important because that's actually determined the business model of the web ever since. Because when you think about it, if you grow a business on the web, you have to start it and give it away for free and then work out how to monetize it. And that's because of the way it's designed.
You work on something called Semantic Web.
Yeah.
you sort of explore the interface between life sciences and the physical sciences.
Well, they're two separate things, really. Well, they are and they aren't. The semantic web, part of Tim's original vision, and it was part of my original vision as well in the work I was doing, was that the web wouldn't just be about linking documents. It would be about linking data. Mm-hmm. Because machines can interpret data much more easily than they can interpret documents. We human beings can read a document yep. and understand what it's about. A machine can't. It can look at the bits and bytes, but it doesn't understand what's in there. Whereas you give a machine some data and tell it what the data's about, as we do in database systems, then machines can do wonderful inference. And that's really what the world of big data is about today, that everyone's getting so excited about. And when you link the data, you make, so it says there's data about me and it says I'm a scientist. So there's a link that explains what I am and what I do by saying I'm a scientist, because the machine will understand that, puts it into another on vocabulary about science. And so you can make the most powerful inferences if you've got links on data as well as documents. And that's what the semantic web is about. And we talk about it as the silent revolution, because the web was a big, you know, it was like people hadn't seen anything like it before. Yeah. So when you first saw a website, it was wow. There's not so much of a wow factor with the semantic web. It's just supporting many of the applications that we build these days. And that's been, I've been part of that really since my early days in hypermedia, and that's really exciting. Now, when we talk about the link with the life sciences, that was when I was really doing some work on memories, how we store our memories, doing a comparison between how the brain stores memories and how we do it in computers, because it's really how we can use computers to help us store our memories for life, yep. we called it.
Interesting.
Increasingly, of course, our memories.
How far have you come with this research? Is it still research?
Well, much of it now is out in the commercial world. So this is I could talk about this topic forever, but if you think about it, the social networks have come along, and yes. Many of our memories are now stored in Facebook.
Yes.
I find that quite, I mean, you know, when you think about it, actually, that's my memory, and why...
And Facebook owns it.
Facebook owns it. And what happens if Facebook changes? Or, I mean, all companies come and go, you know?
Yes.
Facebook and Twitter are the companies at the moment. They won't be forever. You know, but that's my set of photographs. I'm really like... So I think increasingly we're talking about personal data stores, so that we actually... own the data that we create, and we loan it to the companies mm-hmm. or the government, that have our health records and all the other records yep. about. But the other thing that is coming along, which is another big cultural
revolution.
I'm talking about Google Glass. So these are the glasses you put on that you
yes,
can, you know,
that's
you,
right.
you can, as you're walking down the street, I can see information about you. When mm-hmm. I look at you, I can take a photo of you, store it. That's both exciting and potentially very scary mm-hmm. at the same time. And how society adapts to that type of technology, which we've been, you know, I've been involved in prototyping that sort of thing for ages. Now you see a company like Google actually making it commercial, and you see that the, you know, in some places in California and other Canada, I've seen bars will refuse to let people in who are wearing a Google Glass. Mm-hmm. And you can understand it.
Yes,
you know?
Of course.
So there's going to be all sorts of... this is what really excites me about the world I'm in now, is how does society adapt to that? What does it do with it? And, I mean, the big thing at the moment is with the internet, how because of Snowden, we've uncovered the NSA,
yes.
the NSA and the British GCHQ have been effectively spying on the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now we
shame on you, British people.
We have Germany and France saying, "Oh, we're not going to put our internet. The internet's not going to go through America." And this could break the internet. And it was not designed as a system for surveillance,
yep.
you know, and it has been by the big governments. And, I mean, you look at what the Chinese do in a different reasons, different way. They're They try and censor and control how people use it. So they don't use the technology so much as the thought police to tell people you can't, you know, you have to be careful what you say. And so this was, the internet was designed to be a place for open of sharing of information. So when you start cracking down on it, either using the technology to spy on people or censorship, you potentially break it. And we could lose this thing before it's even had a chance to take off.
Do you have more concerns about the direction of, you know, technology? Or are you...
I think it's really important... there's a strong move. I've just been appointed to a commission, a global commission on internet governance. There's more than one of those at the moment. And people like Tim Berners-Lee and Vint Cerf, who invented with Bob Kahn, effectively, the internet.
The World Wide Web.
Well, no, Tim invented the World Wide Web. Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf invented TCP/IP, which mm-hmm. is the basis on which the internet as we know it today works in terms of network protocols. These people are out there trying to say, you know, before you governments crack down and try and take control, think about what you might be breaking and losing if you do that. And I think this is really important. It's an important crossroads for the internet, for the world. Really, really crucial. And I don't know if the Magna Carta means anything to you here in Malaysia. This was 800 years ago next year. In the UK, there was a big document signed by the king at the time, King John, to say what rights the people had. Mm-hmm. This is the Magna Carta. If you okay. go to the British Library and our National Archives, there are about 8 copies of it, I think. So it was the first human rights document. And it's 800 years next year. And I think that what we need, I'm not the only person saying this is a Magna Carta for the internet. We need to know what our human rights are, who can do what with our data. We don't need to know exactly all the time, but we need some openness about who is doing what with our data on the internet and who has the right to do what.
Do you think that the women's participation in science, technology and, you know, math and engineering has changed with the onset of technology?
Well, that's a yes and a no.
Has it made it easier for us
to get involved? In some ways, it's made it easier because you can work more from home. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's changed yet in terms of that profile piece. You can have a strong profile on the internet, but I still think you have to be physically present at conferences and in those networking sessions at the moment. Mm-hmm. So yes and no.
Okay. And just moving on, you're all here in Malaysia. I mean, what are you here for?
Well,
and you come quite often, I understand, 2-3 times a year.
Well, we have the University of Southampton has a campus in Johor Bahru in mm-hmm. Iskander.
Yep.
Where we are focusing, specialising in engineering, and we are teaching degree courses in mechanical engineering and electrical and electronic engineering, and it's a 2+2 degree, so the students have 2 years here in Malaysia and then they come to Southampton. Now, Southampton, people might not realise it because we don't say it often enough. We're at the real top of the tree in engineering in the UK. We're about as good as it gets mm-hmm. across the board in engineering.
How are your women doing?
Oh, that's cruel. Well, I tell you what, I'm going to the campus this week, at the end of this week, and the top student last year was a woman.
Fantastic.
And that's often the case. We don't have enough in the UK, but I'm really hoping to get some of those women who are doing those science subjects at school here in Malaysia to come and study with us in our engineering courses.
We need to have a surveillance system to make sure they don't be a part of that leaky pipe, isn't it?
No, we don't want a surveillance system. No. Observation systems,
okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay, Snowden comes to mind.
No, I think you can observe the trends without having to spy on people. Mm-hmm. You can do that on the internet, and that's the work I'm interested in.
Interesting. You know, despite women in science still being paid less, promoted less frequently, win fewer grants and are more likely to leave research than similarly qualified men, how would you engage girls to participate in science, technology, engineering and mathematics?
Well, of course, a lot of the things you said there are true in other careers as well.
Yes.
All right. So, unfortunately, I think there is a much more of a focus on diversity because I think people really understand now that you need diverse teams in everything, and science and engineering included. The thing that I say to people is that you can really change the world if you become a scientist or an engineer. If you think about all the... look at this studio that we're sitting. This is all the result of science and engineering. The people, the device that they're listening to this program on is all the result of science and engineering. Yeah, when you go into a hospital and you have an MRI scan or a new drug, that's all the result of science and engineering. Scientists and engineers change the world. And women can help us change the world for the better.
Do you think writing code is going to be the future?
I think that we will always need good computer scientists. And software engineering is really, really important. We need good software engineers. Increasingly, though, it's changing and more of it's becoming automated. But the design aspects of this, of what we're trying to build using computers, are becoming increasingly important.
Okay. So the areas that come to mind now, immediately, Dame Wendy, in science, technology, engineering and mathematics, that we need more people to participate in. Which areas would those be?
Oh, I wouldn't like to be too specific. We hugely need people with IT skills. Of course, I'd say that. I'm from the IT world. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, everything we do these days depends upon computers. We need really good engineers in mechanical, aeronautical, electronics, civil, ship. It goes on and on. I just think we need more people with those types of skills because we need that skill base in the workforce.
Is there necessarily a cause that's more masculine than it is feminine in this area?
You're throwing me some curveballs today. people used to say that, you know, being a civil engineer and walking around a building site with a hard hat on and heavy boots. But, you know, women love that as much as men if they get into it. So, no, I don't think so.
Depends on your personality as well.
Exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Your message on championing women in the sciences.
My message is just do it. Just do it because the career potential is fantastic and, the world needs us.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Dame Wendy Hall, Professor of Computer Science and Dean of the Faculty of Physical Science and Engineering, University of Southampton, UK, on championing women in science, technology, engineering and mathematics on The Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.